Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Gerald Jorgensen, 18855. I represent Daryl Erickson and Erickson Construction, who are the appellants here, and they were the plaintiff in the case below. This case involves a general contractor who rebuilt a home after tornado damage, was subsequently deprived of remaining insurance funds by the Statums, who are the appellees, and the counterclaim, or they were defendants below and counterclaim plaintiffs, who refused to sign over an overhead and profit distribution check from an insurance company. That brought about the suit. The Statums then countersued for defective construction. There's a number of items in the brief. I want to focus on just a few of those. In summer of 2008, tornado struck the Statums home in Windsor, Colorado. The Statums hired Daryl Erickson and Erickson Construction to do the repairs. And upon substantial completion, the Statums refused to turn over funds that were included in a fourth and final payment from the insurance carrier who was financing the reconstruction. The monies in that final check were for overhead and profit that was negotiated between Mr. Erickson and the insurance carrier, completely out of any contact with the Statums.
Does that matter?
I think it does, because I think there's a separate contract between Mr. Erickson and the insurer that has been violated basically by this court order. That was not contemplated in the original contract. Neither of the parties, everybody's admitted that they didn't know that that was available, that Mr. Erickson went to the insurer and argued for how much he should get as far as overhead and profit, changed what he was going to do in the case. He originally was going to make his profit by picking up subcontracts, but as soon as he found out that he would actually be paid for being a general contractor, then he quit picking up those subcontracts and subcontracted that information, those jobs out.
That was a separate contract. There's not a written contract, I take it.
No, there was an offer by the insurance carrier to Mr. Erickson. Mr. Erickson accepted that offer.
But then when the insurance company presented the money, they did that in a joint check with the policyholder. Why did they do that?
They didn't. Actually, they passed it to a second mortgage, and the second mortgage passed it to a first mortgage, and then the first mortgage wrote it jointly to them so that they could avoid getting involved in a conflict, I guess, is their approach.
Mr. Jorgensen, yes. Wasn't Mr. Erickson at all times pertinent to this case acting as a general contractor?
Yes, he was, but he picked up subcontract jobs, so to speak. He did the framing, he did some of the other work.
When you say picked up, you mean he had subcontractors do some of the work?
No, I mean just the opposite, Your Honor. There's a term in the field that's called picked up. In other words, if you're a general contractor and you bid a contract out to do a construction,
you always have the option to do the subcontractor's work yourself.
Pick it up, so to speak.
And are you aware of any case in Colorado that says that a general contractor is not responsible for the breach of contract of its subcontractors?
Yes, absolutely.
Would you cite that to me?
That actually is the standard. The standard is, just a second, I'll fix my...
I understand that a general contractor is not liable for the torts of his subcontractors, but my understanding of law, Mr. Jorgensen, is that a general contractor is responsible for all of the subcontractor's performance, including their contractual obligations. And if you have a case that says the opposite, I'd really like to see it.
Well, there's three cases that I have, Ron, and I can't remember which one of the three. It's Western Stock Center would be the primary case, which is a 1978 Supreme Court case, which adopted the Restatement Second of Torts.
I'm specifically asking you for a contract case, not a tort case.
Hildebrandt was a mixed question of contract and tort. And Huddleston, I'm not sure about. So I do not know of any case that, that specifically has a contract provision, but I don't see the distinction, I have to admit. There was an agreement for him to operate as a general contractor. And in that capacity, a general contractor hires independent contractors. They would not be his agent, so under the agency theory, they would not be liable back on that. Also, there is a case that indicates that, that if they delegate the duty, they need to make sure that they delegated the responsibilities, and clearly in this relationship that he had with his subcontractors, he was delegating both the duty and the responsibility. So I think if you look at it as a just under an agency theory, that would fit under the contract auspices, very similar to what happens in a tort context. Some of the issues that I think are going to have that have repercussions across the construction industry is the issue with regard to the mitigation. There was an order by the court, or the court's statement basically was, is that once there's a pending litigation, in other words, when the contractor sues for payment, that it negates any necessity on the part of the homeowner or the person owning the property to do anything with regard to mitigation. I don't believe that that's the law. There was no authority for it whatsoever in the court's order. And it even moved from a point of not so much as a question of whether it was reasonable for them to do mitigation. It moved from the court's order into more of a phrase of, yes, yeah, there's no duty of mitigation once that you've been sued. So if you hold back, or if you hold on to those issues so that in case you do get sued, since there's already an issue regarding payment, that seemed to the trial court to be appropriate.
Didn't the court take into consideration that there was some inappropriate behavior by Mr. Erickson toward the homeowner, and that was part of the reasonableness of denying any sort of reentry to do the damages and mitigation?
I think that's the only thing the court did take into consideration. There was testimony that after the date of substantial completion, which I'm saying is sometime in July of that year, clear out in October, there was a party at which the participants got overly intoxicated. It was an embarrassing thing. It probably was a family issue because these are cousins. But that should have had little or nothing to do with the contract. Second of all, your duty to mitigate under the, not necessarily a duty to mitigate, but the CADERA or the Colorado, the Colorado Defect Action Reform Act, it has pretty much a codified mitigation of damages set up right within it, which means that once there's an issue that arises in a construction defect case, you have 75 days in which the contractor can analyze the defects and come back with some kind of an offer. Oftentimes there is very heated or very uncomfortable relationships develop in these conflicts. And still, CADERA is written so it specifically has it so that the contractor can come on the premises, the contractor can look it over, can say what he wants to remedy or what he can remedy, and make an offer based on that. And there was supposed to be a time period given to do that. There was no compliance with CADERA whatsoever.
Wasn't the remedy for the failure to provide the list of defects getting a stay of the proceedings, and was it any motion for stay ever filed?
There's no motion for stay ever filed. The situation was that as far as a mitigation, what I'm using is to show it as an example of mitigation is ingrained into the system, and we completely ignored it in this case. And part of that mitigation, I think a stay should have been ordered. I raised the issue twice with the court, and both times was denied that they had no, because of a court's reading of the Land Wells decision, which was a decision that I was also involved in before this court, The reading of Rand Wells, according to this judge, was is that you don't, nobody has to comply with the statute, basically.
At what stage was your Rand Wells claim raised?
It was raised at, there was a summary judgment that was originally filed. I think it was at the same time that we were denied on our motion for the civil theft claim in that round of summary judgment motions. The third thing is that it's an economic waste. What happens when a contractor has subcontractors that have made mistakes or made errors in their work is that the subcontractor is required to go out and protect those things. And if they're not allowed access to the property, as they were in this place, they were actually removed or thrown off the property when they went out to try to investigate the defects that they were being accused of. Then what happens is we end up with a subcontractor that should be taking care of something, and instead that comes through as a damage award against the general contractor, when the general contractor has already paid that subcontractor for doing that work and doing that work in an efficient manner, in an effective manner. So I'd like to reserve whatever time I have left.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Kimberly Shutt, registration number 25947. I'm appearing here this afternoon on behalf of Timothy and Beth Statham, the defendants and counterclaimants below. We submit that what the trial judge did here was exactly what she was entrusted to do. She sat through 2 days of extensive testimony and other evidence. She assessed the credibility of the parties and their witnesses. She considered the weight of the evidence, applied the proper standards or burdens of proof, and then issued an order which did not decide this case in a mere 2 or 3 sentences, but issued 12 pages of specific, single-spaced, written findings of fact and conclusions of law, all of which were supported by competent evidence in the record. To the extent that those weren't sufficiently clear, the judge then reiterated those findings in another order a few months later, addressing Mr. Erickson's post-trial motion regarding the attorney's fees findings. And she again issued specific findings which did not mince words and told you exactly what she thought of the claims here, finding that if ever there was a case for an award of attorney's fees, this was it. The 8 different issues that Mr. Erickson has raised on appeal here do not provide any valid basis for overturning any of those findings or conclusions. Mr. Erickson makes a number of arguments which appear to misunderstand the standard of review. It's not a matter of whether he can point to some bits of testimony that might support his position. In fact, many of the items that he points to, the trial judge specifically found lacking in credibility below with respect to Mr. Erickson's testimony and that of his expert witness. The question here is whether or not there is sufficient evidence in the record to support the trial judge's decision such that it's not clearly erroneous. And we believe that under that standard, her findings passed that test. Many of the arguments, particularly with respect to the Construction Defect Reform Act and the civil theft claim, even if one could fashion an argument that the judge somehow committed a technical error, which we disagree with, it would be a harmless error. It would not change the ultimate outcome of this case. Given the number of issues which he has raised, I'll try to specifically delve into a few of those. But overall, we believe that none of them present any reason for overturning this decision. With regard to the court's interpretation of the contract, it's important to point out that Mr. Erickson's theory of this case and with regard to that contract was a moving target. He first alleged in his complaint, a verified complaint, that there was a written contract between the parties. He argued that again in his motion to dismiss some of our counterclaims, but by the time we got to trial, he was instead arguing that this really wasn't a contract, it was more of a proposal or written estimate that was supposed to fluctuate based upon what the insurance company had paid. Now, he's contending that he had a separate contract with the insurance company. Notwithstanding some of the questions that he asked of the insurance adjuster, which is reflected in her deposition testimony admitted as an exhibit at trial, which she clearly acknowledged that there was no contract between Mr. Erickson and the insurance company. Rather, that was pure and simply between the Statums and their own insurance company.
Who acknowledged that? Was it counsel or was it
counsel? If you review the questioning of Ms. Christy Kingring, the insurance adjuster, it repeatedly shows that he recognized that the contract was between Statums and their insurance company. That was the insurance, the contract which was providing the benefits paid here.
Was the separate contract with the insurance company argument presented in the trial court at all?
I don't believe so. Mr. Erickson argued in his appellate brief here that he presented it in his closing arguments at trial. If that's the case, I don't believe it was adequately before the court. It was undisputed at trial here that the only written agreement between the parties was this written contract of repairs that was drafted by Mr. Erickson himself and specifically labeled as a contract for repair. He testified unequivocally that the amount at the bottom was what he intended to charge the Statums for repairing their house after the tornado. It included all of the additional items that the parties had gone through and noticed needed repair but were not included in the insurance estimate. Mr. Erickson admitted it says nothing about being dependent at all upon what the insurance company paid. And it was undisputed that the parties never reached any other agreement for payment of overhead and profit or any other amounts other than what was reflected in that contract.
Shut.
Yes.
I grant you that the example that I'm going to talk about is far different than what's presented here. But
okay.
When you have your car damaged,
mm-hmm.
and you place it with a body shop for repair, isn't it frequent that the repairman will deal directly with the insurance company, and if he finds something that wasn't on the original estimate, he can call the insurance company and get compensated an additional amount without knowledge of the automobile owner?
That I don't know, Your Honor, but I do know with regard to the construction industry, it was specifically testified that by our expert, Mr. Michael Zaff, that if there's any change in the original contract price, whether it's $50 or thousands of dollars, the proper means of addressing that is to
change
go back through a change order.
Yeah. All right.
And we submit that if Mr. Erickson had these discussions with the insurance company regarding overhead and profit, the proper means for him to have addressed that would have been to go back to the Statums and say, I didn't build overhead and profit into my original contract with you, which would have been the reasonable thing to do according to industry standards to begin with. So we need to have a change order for this additional amount. He never did that. My clients didn't know he was having these discussions with their insurance company. They testified that if they had known, they certainly wouldn't have agreed to him being paid any more additional amounts given the fact that he failed to fill his duties as general contractor and had left him with a number of items that were still not completely repaired or repaired to their satisfaction.
Mr. Jorgensen says that there was a separate agreement then that, in effect, that the insurance company agreed with his client to pay that fee to the client.
And we dispute that. If you do review the testimony of the insurance adjuster, she said she never guaranteed that money to him, recognizing her contract was not with Mr. Erickson. It was with the insureds, Mr. and Mrs. Statham. And if you also look at you have to keep in mind that any amounts the insurance company was paying for overhead and profit was part of the insurance benefits. It's part of the replacement cost value that Mr. and Mrs. Statham paid a premium for and paid a higher premium in order to have that better insurance coverage. And there's case law cited in our briefs. Granted, it's from other jurisdictions because Colorado does not appear to have addressed this particular issue. But it says even if an insured doesn't hire a general contractor, if it's the type of job that would ordinarily require a general contractor to manage different trades coming in and out to do repair work, they are entitled to compensation for what the reasonable cost of having a general contractor, including overhead and profit.
But that O&P wasn't in the initial estimate of money that would be paid by the insurance company, right?
Well, there was just the initial estimate. don't know whether it was built into the costs that the insurance company allocated initially.
Well, they paid the initial amount and then an additional amount for the O&P, right?
Well, it was not just O&P. The final check included $12,000 allocated for O&P as well as other replacement cost benefits. The insurance company pays the actual cash value of the lost first, including any amounts for depreciation. And then once the repairs have been made, then they pay the replacement cost value.
That check became stale and never paid?
It became stale when it was in the hands of the mortgage company. The parties got together in July of 2009 and Mr. Erickson refused to sign over, refused to endorse the check. And so my clients had a check that was not worth anything. They couldn't endorse it. And the funds remained with the second mortgage holder in escrow. With regard to the mitigation of damages issue, what happened here was Mr. Erickson, the parties got together, tried to resolve this. My client thought they were still talking, still going to exchange information. Then Mr. Erickson turned around and sued them just a few weeks after that. We filed our answer, which specifically set forth a detailed list of the defects which we believed to exist at the residence. And that followed on the heels of a letter that was sent to Mr. Erickson's counsel outlining those same list of defects before we even filed our answer. My clients came home one day to find unauthorized subcontractors there working on their house after they had been sued. No one contacted them to get permission to come onto their property to find out, you know, what repairs were still needing to be made. And that happened not once, but twice, even after we had said, you can't send anyone to our house without getting permission for you to come. You know, we need to be part of this discussion. That is not a failure to mitigate damages. It was reasonable conduct on the part of my clients. Mitigation of damages is where they would have failed to take reasonable steps, and because of that, their damages grew greater. Here there was testimony that the French doors leaked, the garage door leaked, such that there was water intrusion. If my clients had come back and claimed additional damage for water damage and had failed to take reasonable steps to prevent that, that would be mitigation of damages. What they are talking about here is not mitigation of damages. And we have submitted specific case law, the Stone versus Satriana case, Airborne Inc. versus Denver Air Center, which says parties have no affirmative duty to make repairs or reduce damages to preclude the other side from suffering that loss. And certainly, the trial court implicitly found that my clients acted reasonably by not allowing these unauthorized contractors to come onto their property to make repairs. Mr. Erickson has relied heavily on the Ranta construction case in arguing mitigation of damages. That case doesn't deal generally with mitigation of damages law. It turns on specific contractual language there, which in that case required the homeowners to allow the contractor to come in and remedy defects in the windows if they were not discovered before installation. The contractual language on which that case turned is not present here and not an issue. Regarding liability for subcontractors, Judge Graham, you hit the nail on the head. It's a completely different context when you're talking about tort, being responsible for injuries caused by your independent contractors or third parties, and when you're talking about delegating the contractual duties that you've assumed to other people to fulfill and they've failed to fulfill that. You are still liable for those contractual failures when you're the general contractor.
Well, there aren't separate contracts here between the owners and the subcontractors.
There are not.
They're proceeding to repair under the terms of the general contract.
Correct. And pursuant to that contract, Mr. Erickson contracted to be responsible for overseeing the work and of subcontractors. That was his duty. And he undisputedly failed to do that here. Our expert testified that it would be standard to at least regularly, if not daily, come and check on the work being done by your subcontractors to make sure that problems don't snowball into bigger problems. And the evidence presented at trial here was that Mr. Erickson barely, if anything, came to the project a couple times a month during the course of construction. He certainly wasn't overseeing his subcontractors. With regard to his contention of some waste, if he thought he always had the option of naming those subcontractors as third parties on our counterclaims here, and he never did so. But he's certainly still responsible for their inferior work on a contractual basis. With regard to the award of attorney's fees here, I would again say that it's a matter committed to the trial court's discretion. It's not to be disturbed on review if supported by the record. The trial court made very specific findings here about Mr. Erickson's contentions contradicting his own allegations in the complaint, making claims that were likely instituted to intimidate the Statums, finding that his evidence lacked credibility, and then reiterated those findings in her motion, in her order addressing the Rule 59 motion. Those same claims and arguments have been perpetuated here on appeal. Mr. Erickson's disregarded the standard of review, misrepresented the trial court's findings as to credibility of the evidence, and raised a number of issues which would constitute harmless error in any event. So we're asking you to please affirm the trial court's findings, award us our attorney's fees on appeal as well.
Sure.
Thank you.
Mr. Jorgensen.
Mr. Jorgensen, just the document that started all of this, the so-called proposal,
yes.
Is it your position that that is or is not a binding contract?
That's a binding contract,
okay.
In as far as it goes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that was always our contention. There was confusion on the part of my client on the stand. The remark from the court was something to the effect of, your client doesn't understand your theory of the case. Well, I'm not sure my client's supposed to understand the theory of my case, and kind of implies that I should have coached him more. I think it would be a credibility problem the other direction if I was to tell a client what my theory was and he needed to fill in these blanks. The two contracts are, first of all, in order to do a contract, you have to have people have to both have some idea as to what the content of that contract is and what it's going to cover. And none of the parties knew that there was a possibility of getting this overhead and profit. The way that this will work out, the way that the trial court has set it up, is that it becomes a quite a windfall for one party, and the other party who did the work ends up short by that amount. So one party did the work, the other party gets the payment.
Well, if the insurance company had not coughed up the overhead and profit, Mr. Erickson had agreed to do the repairs for the initial amount in the contract. Is that not correct?
That's absolutely correct.
And so how is it a windfall if he was going to do the work for the money anyway?
Because after he was told that he was going to get it, and in reliance upon that, he changed his strategy to the whole project and hired subcontractors to do the work. Right, and then he just filled the role as the general contractor.
There's no representation by the Statums in that regard. I mean, to the extent that there was a representation, it would have been by the insurance company making a representation that they can reimburse for those expenses.
Exactly.
But you want that attributed to the Statums, that he acted in reliance?
No, it's a separate contract. It had nothing to do with the original contract. You can't make a contract for something you don't know is going to happen.
So, I mean, what I'm concerned about is if there's a contract with the insurance company and he's entitled to being paid by the insurance company, your theory that the Statums have to pay that over to him is based on
the fact that they're holding his funds.
So this is a civil theft?
That's what the civil theft claim was all about.
Okay.
It's like, hey, the insurance company gave you my check, and you're not going to chip it over.
So you agree there's no breach of contract then, just a civil theft for the holding of the money that was the separate contract between Mr. Erickson and the insurance company?
Only $12,000 of the remaining $18,000 or $19,000 of that check was related to the overhead and profit. The remainder of that was monies that was part of the $82,000.
Still saying there was a breach of contract as to that part?
Yeah.
Because?
Because he didn't get paid in full. Even if you just took the $82,000 contract amount. But the primary piece of that is, the argument as to whether it's RCV or ACV, the argument as to whether or not that he had already relinquished the rest of the proceeds because he had turned over a check for $10,000 to the state so that they could put in their own carpet and tile. So that was that is not in any means a clear argument.
Thank you, Mr. Jorgensen.
Thank you
again, Ms. Kittle. Ms. Shutt, excuse me. Apologize. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course. That completes.